you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
Welcome to the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. I'm Chuck Shelton, the CEO of Great Art Consulting, and I have the honor of hosting a series of conversations about the impact inclusive leaders can have. Let's start a great-hearted conversation. Today on the show, we're excited to have Robert Baker, the CEO of Potentia Talent Consulting Limited, based in London. At Potentia, Rob advises companies on their approach to the D&I market. Rob has more than four decades of experience in disrupting work cultures for the betterment of historically disadvantaged employees. Before starting Potentia, Rob was with Mercer as its leader of diversity and inclusion consulting for the international region. This is where I got to know him. Before that, Rob spent 15 years as global client relationship director, managing and developing several large multinational clients across all Mercer's lines of business and regions. He has been appointed disruptor in residence in diversity and inclusion at EDEC Business School in Nice, France. I love that title, Rob. Rob is also a non-executive director at Spectral, the pay gap analysis specialist. And further, he serves as director of Aspiration CIC, which aims to help people with Asperger's syndrome and or high functioning autism achieve employment and developing fulfilling careers. Rob and I have had the chance to do some great work disruptively over the years together. And today we're going to talk about a global view on men as allies. Hi, Rob. It's an honor to have you here on the show today.
Chuck. Yeah, Chuck, thanks. It's great to be here with you. And I mean, thanks so much for the invitation. It's really great to have an opportunity to engage with you and the listeners on the topic of allyship. But when you asked me to kind of come on the podcast, I was thinking, you know, kind of really should try and define allyship a bit because it gets talked about a lot. And I came across one recently from Lean In, the organization that I think Sheryl Sandberg founded, where they define allyship as an active and consistent effort to use your privilege and power to support and advocate for people with less privilege. So, Chuck, I don't know whether that's a definition you share, but I thought that was very powerful. And it really made me think about, okay, so how am I showing up and using my power and privilege to support people in that situation?
That's brilliant. It underscores the necessity of us doing our own work around how we see our privilege and power, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, I got on to, so then what do I mean by privilege, right? So then I had to think about that. And, you know, for me, I mean, privilege is about the benefits that I've got and accrue to people like me because we fit into a specific social group or have specific dimensions to our identity. And in fact, I was talking with a woman of color earlier today about the kind of privilege that as a white, you know, Western European, middle class, straight white man, I actually have. And the responsibility I actually have then to use that privilege. And she's challenged me to use it. And so we're going to work together on how I can do that and support some of her goals and aspirations. So this is about putting this into practice, Chuck, really.
Yeah, it's such an example, Rob, of that coming alongside in a way that's authentic for us and staying in service, you know, to others. Privilege is one of the ways I've learned to think about it, is kind of the accumulation of advantage. I think you and I share the layers, many of the layers of advantage, and the idea of to whom much is given, much is expected shows up, right? Because then you get that invitation, like you got, to take responsibility for what we have and to turn it in the direction of support so that others can move away from disadvantage that often comes with identities and move towards advantage, which is so a practical way to think about ally work and inclusive leadership. For you, what about your early life and career led you to focus on being an ally to women and others? Why are you doing this?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. And I sort of sat and thought through a little bit, you know, kind of why am I here and why did I get involved? And I think, you know, I've got to reflect on the fact that my mother had a major influence on me because she was one of those caring but also quietly strong women that I kind of came across in my life. And unfortunately, she and my father have both now passed, so I can talk relatively freely about it. But I think what I saw in the family home was my father was a kind of typical working class kind of guy who wanted to dominate in the family, dominate the conversations. I mean, he was a lovely man, my father, and he was by no means, you know, an ogre or anything, but typically for men of his generation, you know, he wanted to dominate things. So I saw really how, you know, my mum reacted to that and how I saw her sometimes withdrawing and deferring to him. And I saw how quiet sometimes she was. And I thought, wow, you know, she's got so much to offer and yet she's not getting a chance to offer it. So what I vowed was that I'd never do the same with any woman that would be my partner or my wife. And that, I think, just made me kind of get started down that road of thinking, well, what are the relative positions of men and women? And then, of course, I brought that into the workplace. And then sort of looking at the workplace, what I realized is that actually a lot of women in the work, but when I first joined a consulting firm in 1978, for example, in the UK, there were very few women in positions of power. You know, it was amazing to me, having been at university with many women, actually in the consulting world at that time, most of the women were secretaries or administrators. So it was kind of like, you know, kind of, wow, what's happening? Why do we have such a lack of balance, you know, kind of in the workplace? So those are some of the things that kind of really struck me.
Yeah, I'm struck by the, you and I have a lot of, we're peers by age, but we're peers by other ways that we're now just discovering. My mom was the forceful in my family. My mom was kind of the leader, the verbal one, and my dad was a much quieter type. So a different dynamic than you.
Yeah.
But I drew the same conclusions. You know, it's just like I wanted to go into my adult life, and I was pretty aware of this, to getting to be around people, including women, who were trying to be as much of themselves as they could be. And I didn't want to be part of limiting that or participating in structures that pushed me ahead of people or into a position with them that I hadn't earned, didn't deserve, or that I was going to be on the short end if I didn't get to see their giftedness and you know what they had to bring. So that's, those are deep roots for us in this work. How did you, what was the process, since the idea of ally work wasn't something that was presented to us as we began our careers, but it's emerged so powerfully over those intervening decades. How'd you get started as an ally to women in particular, and how's that allyship work unfolded for you?
Well, I mean, Chuck, I mean, it really came about through my involvement with the Women's Network at Mercer. You know, and I helped actually get the Women's Network established in London, where I was working. And I worked with the chair of the network to kind of grow it and also actually to bring in men. So quite early on, we thought that, you know, for women to thrive in the workplace, we've got to engage the men in this as well. But through the Women's Network at Mercer, I was introduced to PWN Global. Now, in those days, PWN stood for Professional Women's Network, which was a kind of global women's network that Mercer sponsored. And so through that connection, I met Mary Jo Boss, their president at the time. And I was immediately struck by what she was trying to achieve with gender balance and getting men engaged in it. And she actually had the vision to sort of seek out male executives to get them involved in this. And she recruited me to be the first male board member of PWN Global with the grand title of Vice President Engaging Men. Wow. And I remember my first board meeting, you know, with me, the only guy, with 12 super smart women sitting around at the board table thinking, how the hell do I keep up here and not embarrass
myself? I'm going to go engage some men because this is intimidating.
But it was really fascinating because you know, we learned really, this is the first time they'd had you know, men on the board, as it were. So we learned a lot about how, you know, we go about things, how we engage, how we discuss ideas, you know, how we get things done. And it was a really valuable learning curve for me. And I've got to say, my whole experience with the Women's Network was one where I was very fortunate to get a really good learning out of what I was doing. I think I was contributing as well, but I think I was also learning. And what was fascinating about it was it also introduced me to the city networks of PWN in like different cities, like Amsterdam, Madrid, Brussels, Vienna, Oslo, Warsaw. I mean, I got to see the situation for women like around Europe, principally, because that's where we were holding it. We got to run things like diversity labs, where we got men engaged in these, and we worked on them with the corporate partners. And of course, you know, then I got elected to be co-president of PWN Global, which was like the first time there'd ever been a male co-president of a women's network. And I know there were a few people and a few women probably saying, like, why the hell do we need a man kind of running or co-running this? But it was a far-sighted step, I think, on their part, because it really meant we were sending a signal out there to everybody that gender balance involves men as well as women, and we can work together on this.
Yeah, I so love the I love how you give the impression of kind of wandering into spaces and being surprised by it, but it feels to me like your values and your like to help starting the women's network, and your willingness to even put yourself in kind of that only one situation at that board meeting, I think it says a lot about your sense of yourself and your awareness that for you to grow, you don't have to go into those situations, you get to. And I can only imagine I have my own version of some of that kind of learning, the degree to which being around so many people who identify differently than you in some ways, but are so much like you and share your values. Sound like it was like a really powerful mentoring, steep learning curve, and you're still at it. So you've clearly the start that you made, you got a lot out of it from the beginning.
Well, absolutely. I'm still very much friends with the PWN ladies that I work with, and actually I'm still a global ambassador for PWN.
Yeah.
And I work with some of the city networks on some of the engaging men workshops we're still running even today. So in Brussels and Milan more recently. And then through that, I've been invited to join the board of other women's networks, like One Loud Voice for Women in the UK and the Sister Sister Network, which is a really vibrant global community of women. So, it's continued and it's expanded. And of course, what that's now meant is that it's given me that tremendous experience bank of, what it's like to be engaging men in this whole topic of gender balance. And that's led me, I think, into things like the EDEC, global MBA program role that I have now. So, yeah, the journey's continuing, and I don't think it's ever going to stop until I'm right. 6 foot under, basically.
Yeah. Well, we use the word adventure a lot because it describes partly the unpredictable and sometimes frightening nature of the learning that goes on. So I hear that word adventure in your story. You have this exposure to what you've seen with men across Europe, with such diverse cultures and different moments in the way that gender's playing out, and you've had quite a bit of exposure to that in the United States as well. From your identity and location in the UK, share with us what have you seen? What are some through lines in terms of where men are with ally work across those different locations? And maybe what are some things that you see as different among the different places that you've done ally work?
Yeah. Certainly, Chuck, I've done most of my work in Europe. That's to be kind of fair. But of course, I've got engaged with men's networks in the US, and I've worked at times with Catalyst in the US, on various workshops, etc. I would say most of the work that I've done in Europe has been trying to equip men with the kind of why they're engaged in this and the sort of how. Really, it's about that personal why, helping men get to the point where they can really articulate, from a personal perspective and also for their business as well that they're involved in, because obviously they're normally working in companies. So it's really helping them get to this authentic voice where they can talk to members of their team or talk to their friends or colleagues about, why this matters so much to them. So a lot of the work that I've been doing is trying to help men equip them with that why. And in some of the workshops we run, we actually get them to do their elevator pitch. And that's really fascinating. And we get to hear their elevator pitch, and we get a chance to critique it a little bit and help them. But then, of course, the other thing, and often I think being men, they really want to dive into this, is the how. Okay, so the why, I'm already bought into this, but how do I do it? And then we look at sort of some of the key skills that they need and some of the tools that are available to them to sort of help put that into practice. And what's really great is there's so much good stuff out mm-hmm. there already, whether that's the material from Lenin I mentioned, the Catalyst I mentioned. There's a fabulous book, which you've, I'm sure, come across, Good Guys by Brad Johnson and David Smith. There's lots of good sort of how stuff in there as well. And you know, this enables them to start thinking about, okay, so as a male leader, I can make a difference by, for example, making sure I'm being very intentional about the recruitment and the development of women in my team. You know, I can intervene as a bystander if I see anything taking place that I think is, you know, not right. So those are sort of some of the things that I've been working on, you know, with men in Europe. And a lot of that, I think, is quite similar, probably, to some of the stuff I've done in the US. But in working with men in the US, I mean, for example, I've been working with Ray Arata and Ed Gurewitz of the Better Man movement. Yeah. And during the height of the pandemic, we had all these fantastic Zoom calls on a Friday evening where we got real and we did some really good work on self-reflection, connection, and collaboration. And I think what I saw was a lot of men in the US really open to what I would call the emotional intelligence side of things. They're prepared to discuss being vulnerable, being humble, being open to discuss really deep subjects like, you know, belonging and love. And I think what I'd love men in Europe to do a bit more is to be a bit more open to that emotional intelligence side of things, and be prepared to kind of really discuss the whole aspects of being you know, a man, the emotional side of it, as well as the sort of rational intelligence part of it as well. Does that make sense?
Totally. I think it's so interesting that ally work, which in a sense, you know, ostensibly is directed as with and for others, it becomes such an invitation to us becoming more authentic and healthy ourselves. You know, inside that, the kind of global construct of masculinity, we're often not invited to think about our emotional intelligence and the way we show up. And we certainly get a lot of feedback, many of us, from other people in our lives about, especially people who identify as women, as that being an area for growth. I remember getting that feedback from my mother, my wife, my daughter, you know, and colleagues and friends. So, you know, I found the work of Brené Brown to be really also really useful in that regard, because it's a straight up research based approach to emotional intelligence and vulnerability, which almost never sounds good to men until we start to learn how to do it. And then even if we have some worries about what vulnerability and transparency, you know, can mean, especially as we're around other men, that we can be, it can really fuel our ally muscles in a way that's quite freeing. And
well, absolutely. And Chuck, thinking about kind of the qualities that everyone's talking about, we need in leaders these days. I mean, the pandemic, I think, has definitely shown that we need leaders that can, you know, care, that really care. Right. That can be, you know, emotionally intelligent about the people that they're working with. So I think, you know, these are real skills and competencies that we can work on to develop ourselves as better leaders. And we can obviously learn a lot from the fabulous women leaders that have, you know, shown the way with this kind of stuff. So, I think it's an absolute opportunity here for us to, you know, to parlay this into to being better leaders in the organizations that we work in.
I heard a CEO in a Fortune 100 company recently say that in the last 2 years, he feels like his title's gone from chief executive officer to chief empathy officer. To that very point.
Yeah, absolutely. I would totally endorse that, and I think that's a great idea.
Well, when we think about this work on a company, on the kind of company side, you've had the chance in your consulting career and your networks to see what happens when men as allies becomes part of a capability in the organization. What can happen in an organization when ally work is built out, in particular, men as allies?
Well, I think the principal thing that if men really get into allyship and get behind allyship, is that a company gets a much better capability to recruit, retain, and develop diverse talent, and in particular, women, as we're talking about here. And I think, you know, that's where we think about the challenges that women have in the workplace and how they can advance. And of course, there are certain sectors that have really struggled with that. We know that, for example, construction, energy, engineering, tech, I mean, these are all male-dominated industries which have really struggled with low levels of applications from women. I mean, indeed, one executive of an energy company recently told me he had 10 applications for a new senior role, and they were all from men. So I think, you know, wow. One of the benefits from companies and from getting their men involved in a more sort of capability perspective as allies is it enhances the company's ability to attract and retain that sort of diverse talent. But then I think it's about, you know, how those men show up really as allies. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, they're always very interested in what they need to do. So when I talk to them about what they can do to really show up as allies to those women, then we talk about a range of things that they could be doing, from, you know, engaging other men, obviously, to support gender balance, to, you know, demanding to see the data in the organization about the representation of women, about the mentoring and the sponsorship, etc. And then, of course, what we see, if those men are really doing that and they're really being active, then I think what we get is those real positive outcomes for a business of having more diverse talent, having more female talent. And there we're talking about things like, you know, the company has more ideas and better and innovation, is a better fit with the customer base, which is, you know, often more you know, decisions driven by women than perhaps we realize. And of course, it makes the company more attractive to female, but also a lot of male talent as well, because it's a more welcoming and more inclusive environment. So there's some real business benefits from companies that have got this built out in a sort of more programmatic way as a capability in the organization. And of course, what I'm seeing at the moment is companies recognizing that and want to run workshops to get their male leaders engaged in this whole piece, and then help develop the men as allies within the organization.
I so appreciate your fluency with the why. You were talking earlier about the why with individual men, kind of the elevator pitch. What you just did was give that same elevator pitch for the organization. And it's so clear, it's related, especially in an environment like we're in now, where the loss of talent is a big concern for so many organizations, yeah. And the need, therefore, to attract talent out of the talent base that's actually there, not maybe the traditional talent base or the pipelines, as narrow as they may be construed by certain disciplines. It gets to be pretty existential in terms of the business value for being able to keep the people that you have, to attract the people you need to attract. And this is something you and I have talked about before too. It isn't only a talent, you know, play on the cost side of the business, but it's connected to what companies and clients and customers, what people expect of a company on the external side as well.
Well, absolutely. And you know, now I think a lot of companies realize that if they're pitching for business, for example, they'd be expected to have a team that hopefully looks a little bit like the client's team. And if the client's team's diverse, you know, and their team's not diverse, it doesn't look so good and probably not so, you know, likely to lead to them getting the business. So I think there's some really hard aspects around, you know, why this is so important now that companies get this. And I think, you know, the tide is starting to turn. I think that they're starting to realize that.
Yeah, it's. I'd love to hear, because you're operating in part of your work in a specifically, you know, business environment at EDEC, and it sounds like from what you said that it's you're meeting people who are leaders from all over the world across many cultures. How does the ally agenda? What's the future of it? What's the opportunity in that ally mindset with the students and the people, the business leaders of the future you're working at in a business school?
Well, it's absolutely fascinating. And I'm really encouraged by what I've seen with EDEC. I mean, first thing to say is I'm dealing with 70 global MBA students from 30 different nationalities. 46% of those are women, which is kind of like really fantastic to see that level of women in a global MBA program. And I had some of my first interactions with them in the last month or so. And it's been really fabulous to see how interested they are in this whole topic. And this is the first time in the global MBA program we've put in a diversity and inclusion component. I was asked specifically to come in and do that. And, you know, we started actually by each of them talking about their own experiences of, you know, what they'd come across, you know, whether that was in the workplace or in, you know, in the societies they came from. And, you know, we had people from, you know, from India, Brazil, Africa, talking about their experiences of discrimination, bias, and you know, how that led them to think about this. And of course, it's been very encouraging to see how many of those students now want to be allies to others, so that they're aware of the value of difference what they can do to sort of, you know, communicate, build bridges, work together, etc. So, yeah, I'm very encouraged. There's a lot of interest from the students in this. And why I'm there really is because I want to make sure that the future leaders of businesses, which is what these global MBA students are thinking of diversity and inclusion and equity and justice, you know, first and foremost in what they're doing, because I think that's what the world we are going to have in front of us is going to need. So I'm really delighted that edX's been forward thinking. It's got this into the program, and the student response has been, you know, outstanding. They're really engaging in it, and they want to know more.
That's such a great story. It kind of leads directly to the next question that we love to ask. In times where differences can be such a source of conflict and there's so much division, difference by difference, identity by identity, culture by culture, the story you just told is an example of what can encourage us in the face of things that can be discouraging. In your ally work, what's encouraging you? What keeps you going? What are you seeing that can encourage all of us to keep finding the courage to do this work?
Well, I think the thing that I'm most uplifted by is the thought that there's always something to be optimistic about. And I had this marvelous meeting with a guy called Victor Perton, who's an Australian guy, but he runs the Optimism Academy, I think, in Australia. And his first question to anybody he meets is, what makes you optimistic? And, you know, you can't start by being pessimistic. You've got to think, or, you know, like, okay, so what makes me optimistic? So, you know, when I think about that and the work that I'm doing in allyship, I mean, what really gave and still gives me great hope is actually what I see is the really good aspects of the human spirit, where we support each other, where we try and understand each other, where we have a desire to collaborate and cooperate, you know, in building a better world. And what we know is, for example, the challenges in front of us, things like climate change, things like diversity, equity, and inclusion, those are going to require us to work together. So the fact that we have something within us that makes us want to do that, I think is my source of optimism. And, you know, it's interesting because the progress for gender balance and gender equality has actually been relatively slow to date. But what I see is that speeding up with the interest that especially younger generations taking now and younger men coming through as well. And I had this conversation with Julian earlier today, one of the global MBA students who really wants to become an ally to women. He was asking me, you know, how did I get started? And now he's joined PW in Nice, and he wants to work with them and volunteer and support in any way he can. And I was asking him, like, what's your motivation really for this? And he said, I want to make a difference. Mm-hmm. He said, when I go into a company, I want to make a difference as a leader by, for example, ensuring we have gender balanced recruitment and promotion. We don't have a significant gender pay gap, that I'm sponsoring and mentoring female talent. And so to me, what makes me optimistic is people like Julian saying, you know, I want to get involved. I want to play a part. I want to make a difference. So the fact that this new generation is coming through, it makes me super optimistic. And of course, my job now is to help support them and then kind of get out of the way.
Yeah, that is encouraging. I love the call out to the generational aspect of this. And we see that in our work too. And I see that in my own team. People who are of a different generation than me, who are just so deeply committed and really represent the right direction and energy in so much of what still needs to be done. You mentioned earlier, Rob, the predisposition that we, many of us as men, have to the how, to the action, which I can understand sometimes can be wearisome, but I'm like that too. So as we get close to wrapping up here with another way to talk about the how, what's the most important thing a man who seeks to be an ally should do?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, really. I got to kind of answer it on two levels, I think, because I think actually getting started on this allyship work is the most important thing a man can do. And I think the first thing that they should do is actually listen. They need to listen and educate themselves about the lived experience and perspectives of to those who they would be allies to. So this helps them really enhance their awareness of their own privilege and the biases that they have and get started on their personal journey and building their authentic voice around the why. Because actually the why is part of the how. If they want to convince other men to engage in this, they've got to have a really good story around the why. So I think for me, gender balance, for example, has involved listening to the voice of women, both in the workplace, at home, and in society. And when I was at Mercer, one of the really fun things we did was we recorded 6 different women in different levels of the company talking about their experiences in the workplace. And we played it to the men, and they were really blown away by some of the things that the women said, things that were pretty obvious to the women, but not so obvious to the men. Like, for example, what time of day do we set important meetings to? You know, let's set them at a time that's, you know, family friendly. Or, you know, what roles do we assume women can take on? Well, actually, you know, women can take on any role. So I think that the first thing is really listening and educating yourself as a man to become an ally. And then I think the next thing you've got to do really is take action. Because I think it's one thing to vocally support a cause and to think about the issues, but actually one of the things that really matters is getting started and taking action. So what I encourage male allies to do is think of themselves as change makers or activists, really getting involved in the change and bringing it about. And then, of course, they've got to think about the where they do this. And it is important they do it in the workplace. But it was really interesting to hear from Meeta Malik from Carter in your first podcast, who said, actually, the biggest challenge in diversity inclusion is the work that needs to start at home and in the community. And she asked a great question, which I must admit, got me thinking. She said, like, where do we live? Who are our neighbors and friends? No. And are they diverse or are we self-segregating? And her comments really challenged me to think about that and my own situation and you know, resolve to expand my network. So I think, you know, we've got to really get started on this work, and we've got to actually take action, and we've got to think about doing this at home and in the societies we're in, as well as in the workplace. And I think, you know, it is something for men to equally share the responsibility and the mental and the physical load of housework, childcare, and elder care. Because I think this has become so critical. And of course, the pandemic has really shown up the imbalances that there have been there. Yeah. And that's something that men as allies can really start. And, you know, often in our workshops, you know, one of the questions we ask the men is like, well, who cleans the toilet at home? You know, because like that's something which we've got to get involved in too. So I think there's, it's really important that we look at this, as I say, from the home, from the workplace and the society we're being allies in as well.
I so appreciate the combination of the value set that you're fluent around and the practicality of it. You know, we might not lead with toilet cleaning, but it goes right to the point, doesn't it? That this means we put our hands to the work with people that we're around, people we live with, people we work with, people we serve in really practical ways, because our allyship ultimately depends upon being seen to be an ally. Not only in our motivation or what we, you know, how we want to express that. So appreciate that perspective. As we wrap up here, love to find out, and for the listeners, where can people find you online?
Well, first thing to say is I'd love to get feedback from listeners and you know, their thoughts on what we've been talking about on this podcast. So you can find me on LinkedIn, Robert Baker, CEO, Potential Talent Consulting. I'm also quite active on Twitter, where my handle is at RobertBKR. And then if anyone wants to contact me by a good old-fashioned email, Robert@potentia-talent.com. I'm sure we can share that with listeners afterwards. Those will be the best kind of ways to get in touch. And obviously, I would be delighted to have conversations with anyone that wants to connect with me after this. And Chuck, all I would conclude by saying is thank you for having me on this podcast with you. It really has been a fabulous opportunity and a real blast too.
Thanks, Rob. I inevitably feel when we talk that I'm part of a loving conspiracy that is generative and very motivational. So thanks so much for being in this work and being a partner in it. It's a joy to talk with you today. This brings us to the end of this episode. My deepest thanks to you, Robert Baker, for joining us for an honest and great-hearted conversation. Thank you to our listeners for spending this time with us. We hope that you heard something of value and that it helps you lead more inclusively. As always, thanks for listening to the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. See you next time.
You can bring your stories to the table as a partner and a host on the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. Visit inclusioncatalyst.com and click the link that says join us as a guest host.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.